I'd like to call into session the February 28, 2013 session of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. We are in session. And we have a series of bills up this morning that we're going to be hearing. The first is House Bill 2050. I open a public hearing on House Bill 2050. And Beth, would you please tell us a little bit about that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2050 would change the permissible uses of money in the Oregon Fire Protection Fund and change the limit on annual expenditures from the fund. We just received a fiscal statement on the Dash 1 amendment. You should have both the amendment and the statement in front of you, and there's no revenue impact.
Thank you very much. And committee members, all of the bills that we hear are important, and this is just an important bill. So with that, I'd like to call forward, please, Doug Decker, Travis Medema, and Ken Cummings.
Good morning.
Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Good morning. All right, here we go. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. Very pleased to be here this morning to present to you a package of improvements to Oregon's system of paying for large and costly wildfires. The three components of this package strengthen our ability to fight fire and keep more fires small, to help reduce costs in Oregon's most fire-prone and highest fire-cost districts, and reduce the annual exposure of the state's general fund. My colleagues here, Travis Medema, who's the Deputy Chief of our Fire Protection Division, Ken Cummings, who's the Chair of the Oregon Board of Forestry's Emergency Fire Cost Committee, they're going to describe the mechanics of the impacts of House Bill 2050. But to set the table for the presentation, I wanted to offer a couple of perspectives. You have there before you my written testimony, as well as a letter from the governor encouraging consideration of 2050. I guess the first perspective is that this is the work of an unusual alignment of stakeholders from Eastern Oregon, from Western Oregon, from the Board of Forestry, the Governor's Office, forest landowners. For the last couple of years, there's been a coalition of folks who have been working under the Board of Forestry's guidance in putting together the ideas and the mechanics that are here in 2050. It's been a public process that we've been engaged in. And, you know, really the challenges, the fire challenges that are out there, the occurrence of large fires due to the changing patterns of forest health, the rising costs of large fires, and really some of the basic economics of keeping forest land viable, particularly on low productivity lands, are some of the greatest fire challenges and forestry challenges that we have in Oregon today. So this bill, which is it's the highest priority for the Board of Forestry, for the Department as well, is really aimed directly at those challenges, those three challenges. It improves Oregon's already strong fire funding system, and it really does that by leveraging public and private funds. So Travis and Ken are going to walk you through the improvements, why they're necessary, how they work, and we'll be pleased to respond to your comments, questions, and discussions afterwards.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Medema, and I'm the Deputy Chief of Fire for the Department of Forestry, located here in Salem. It's a pleasure to be here with you today to discuss the Wildfire Protection Act. The concepts embodied within the Wildfire Protection Act, as State Forester Decker mentioned, have been worked on for over 2 years by a broad-based committee. It's the Board of Forestry's number one legislative priority as we look into 13-15 and is fully supported in the governor's balanced budget. I'd like to do a short PowerPoint, if it'll come up. So the challenges, first, at the highest level, the Wildfire Protection Act is really about better protecting our forests, our communities, and key societal values that are produced for Oregonians. Currently, there are some existing challenges within the system, and the Wildfire Protection Act strives to address these challenges. The first challenge are large, costly wildfires. Wildfires, we know, can cost millions and millions and millions of dollars to suppress, and that doesn't even account for the millions in losses when a large wildfire occurs. It also doesn't account for the values of clean air, clean water, and reducing these costs will ultimately save Oregon's long term. The second challenge revolves around this east side productivity and affordability issue. Currently, the lowest productivity lands in the state pay the highest cost of fire protection and also receive the most starts from lightning. They're also infrastructure declining, and when you combine all those pieces together, it makes for a very challenging environment in eastern Oregon, and the Wildfire Protection Act addresses these issues. The last challenge that exists in the fire protection system, it revolves around large fire costs and who pays for large fire costs, and also exposure to the general fund. Partnerships exist in sharing of costs between landowners and the state through much of the system, but when it comes to paying for large fire costs, the system is designed differently, which has led to overtime forest landowners carrying a majority of the cost for large fire. Additionally, the general fund is currently responsible to a higher liability than forest landowners in this deductible portion of fire funding. The concept seeks to lessen the overall exposure to the general fund and equally share costs long-term between the state and forest landowners. The Wildfire Protection Act makes investments both from state and federal and private folks and all landowners to address the current challenges. So how does the Wildfire Protection Act address this and accomplish this? The first and main key component is to increase the statewide severity, and this is kind of the concept around small investments, leverage, and save long-term. Investments made by forest landowners will more than double our existing severity program, and that will increase key resources such as air tankers, helicopters, and ground-based resources, all geared and targeted to put out fires at the smallest possible size, limiting and reducing the number of large, costly, damaging wildfires. It'll work to maintain healthy, viable, working forest and green forest. It'll help maintain a $25 million insurance policy, which protects the state in catastrophic years from large fire costs and helps them protect and maintain those key societal values. The second component of the Wildfire Protection Act addresses this east side affordability issue, and it allocates funding to the lowest productivity lands and helps maintain viable east side working forest. And then the last piece of the Wildfire Protection Act, over three biennia, phases in sharing of large fire costs between forest landowners and the state. Here's a just brief diagram, and I've highlighted in yellow the key components, the three key components of the Wildfire Protection Act. You'll see down there on the bottom in yellow $1 million. That's going into the base level of protection. That's really getting at that east side affordability issue. You'll see a $3 million yellow block there. That's the additional severity component by landowners, again geared to stop fires at the smallest possible size and make those investments to protect large fire cost expenditures and reduce losses of forest resources. And then lastly, the large block there that says $10 million of general fund and $10 million of Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund is the phased-in approach to sharing large fire costs over time. So how are these components funded? The bill requires $1.6 million of new general fund. This will be added to some existing funding to help with the east side affordability issue. This $1.6 million of general fund leverages a new investment by forest landowners of up to $6 million for those severity resources, again, all strategically used to stop fires when they're small, limiting risk and exposure. The concept continues the sharing of the deductible and the large fire cost premium for the insurance policy. And then the last piece is it moves to a phased-in approach of large fire cost sharing. In the first biennium, it shares $2 million annually between the state and landowners. In the second biennium, it's $5 million and $5 million. And then in the third biennium, it's $10 million and $10 million shared dollar for dollar between the state and forest landowners. Ultimately, again, this will lower the general fund's exposure during catastrophic fire seasons by $5 million. However, will increase the likelihood general fund will be paying for large fires. Last, I'll just close with what some of the outcomes, positive outcomes of the Wildfire Protection Act would do. And these key investments really are around small investments up front to save costs long term. It addresses the east side affordability issue. It creates equity across the system. And I liken the WPA or Wildfire Protection Act to preventative health care for Oregon's communities, rural economies, and jobs, and also our valued natural resources. These small investments up front will significantly leverage more dollars long term to help stop fires and reduce costs. Thanks, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Ken Cummings, the chair of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Kenneth Cummings, and I'm representing the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, or the chair of the fund. I'd like to begin my remarks with a cordial reminder of some of the statutes that we underwrite our system with, and the first one is the primary mission of Doug and his team is to put out fire. Fundamentally, the second policy up there is about uncontrolled fire being a nuisance, and I think we all still believe that, but it's also the law. And the third one is more about the fund itself, and the essence of the fund is to provide a balance in suppression costs across protection districts over time. And within the context of this bill, HB 2050 continues to strengthen our position to fulfill that mission. The three different points I'd like to focus on first would be the economic piece of this. As part of our fiduciary responsibility, the Oregon landowners and the public to establish rules and incentives for people on the ground to make the best decisions possible and minimize large fires and their associated costs. That's really what we do. This bill also enhances and provides for that first dollar spent and additional resources up front could easily minimize the 5 or 10 times the dollars that we end up dealing with when the bills come in and having to pay that back. Additionally, the real important piece here is the long-term benefit helps our underwriters when they go out into that world market to place our insurance policy every year. This totally strengthens our position to continue to give them the encouragement that we're doing the right things and always thinking ahead. Working or green forests contribute to the economy for generations versus dead ones that really only create jobs during the first fire season and possibly maybe a year after for salvage. And unless landowners invest in the land, who knows what the future really holds. And a reminder, again, under Oregon law, if there's no salvage activity on a burned piece of property, a landowner is not required to reforest that. Keeping fire small insulates the general fund from huge potential liabilities. And just looking backwards in Washington State last year, it was about a $35 million call out of their general fund for a fire season. 2 or 3 years ago in 2009, California was over $900 million completely paid out of the general fund. On the environmental piece, as a landowner across the entire strata, people that are in the tree growing business, they just have a passion for what they do, and this represents that passion in terms of financial commitment of putting their money where their mouth is. They're willing to step up and enhance their ability to suppress fire and beyond what we have currently. And they care about the entire forest sector, not just the property that they own. Besides being the cheapest dollar anyone could spend to protect the environment and keep forests green or working, this approach keeps valuable resources on the landscape, primarily green trees, riparian zones for shade and cooler water, soil on the hillsides instead of in the stream, homes for wildlife. You just go down the list. Forest fires are the second largest contributor to carbon release in the atmosphere after decomposition. Everybody thinks it's cars, but it's not. From a stewardship point of view, while we can't stop fires entirely, especially on a world basis, we can certainly do our part to greatly minimize the role in this state. From an individual and an Oregonian, I'd like to just remind you that green forests provide that calm and peaceful recreational experience that people long for, whereas burned or dead forests really do not. The sheer peace of mind knowing that the two categories that we just talked about on the economic level and environmental level are in play just improve everybody's well-being. Just green versus black may not be very tangible, but it's simply why I love Oregon. And that's why most of us in the room probably love Oregon and why a lot of people come here. And I think you'd agree the choking smoke in Sisters last summer, 2012, didn't really improve anyone's visitor experience. The fact that families are still employed in rural parts of Oregon because forests are working to some degree lessens that downward spiral of reduced economic well-being in rural Oregon. Certainly less disruption at the family level and continuity, and more likely less reliance on health and family services in our community and our law enforcement. And even if the combined impact of all these were just absolutely minimal, making already scarce resources available for those areas of higher need would be a better deal. The fact is, these three categories outlined above are inexorably linked. And the long-term outcome-based budgeting concept asks those in various capacities of Oregon's leadership to consider these ideas seriously. House Bill 2050 is an exemplary piece of legislation that embodies this approach to solving problems like this as outlined by the governor. And the WPA also underscores the transformational thinking from the Department of Forestry and the leadership that's represented at this table today. And I appreciate the time to speak to you guys. Thanks.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for our panel, Representative Krieger?
I kind of forgot how the taxes go. We have a severance tax and we have a forest tax. Which part of that goes into the fire?
Chairman, Representative Krieger, so into the base level of fire protection is that is essentially a per acre fire patrol assessment that private landowners pay for the base level of fire protection.
Okay. And then you have an additional assessment like to the Coos Forest District on our tax.
The Coos Forest Patrol assessment is basically delivered as it's basically part of that. It is that fire patrol assessment. It doesn't come to us. It's basically for the Coos Fire Patrol.
Okay.
Right. It is at the next level, the large fire cost level. You know, that's where there are several different sources from the landowner community that fund that Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund.
Might be a good opportunity to kind of recap my little operation this year so people see how a small woodland owner might contribute. 469,000 feet, and we have the Coos Forest Patrol, Beaufort Fire District, the forest tax and severance tax was 3,300. Capital gains, federal and state, there's about 50,000 in the bank. The accountant's doing that now. Tree to be starting, planting, I believe, tomorrow is about $2,600. $1,000 to replant, keep those four-footed critters called cows out of there. So there's five taxes plus a property tax. I'm 72, but I'm planting trees, and I intend to harvest them.
Yes.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is being phased in over a six-year period. Why are we taking 6 years to phase it in? Could you enlighten me about that?
I'd say from a practical point of view, every dollar that's available is pretty difficult to come by, as you all well know, and there's a lot of tension around that. And it makes sense that if we take our time and move toward a graduated equity point of view instead of coming down here and asking for that tomorrow, that would probably be a reasonable ask. And just to be real straight up, that makes a lot of sense to me as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that if you didn't salvage after a fire, you didn't have to reforest. Is that applicable to, and you said private lands specifically, I believe, is that applicable to public lands as well?
Vice Chair Esquivel, the standards and procedures associated with Forest Service and BLM reforestation that's not part of Oregon's Forest Practices Act, which is what Ken was referring to. They're governed by a different set of standards about whether or not they salvage, when they salvage, how they reforest, we can talk with you offline about that, but I can't speak specifically to what the federal requirements are for their timing and reforestation relative to salvage.
Thank you, Paul.
Yes, please.
The reason that comes to my mind, we had the Biscuit Fire, and the Biscuit Fire, I believe, was the size of Rhode Island or something like that. It was bigger than some of the states back east. We burnt enough carbon footprint with the burning of it, and I was told this, I don't know if it's true, that it was the equivalent of everyone in the state of Oregon driving their cars for 10 years.
Wouldn't doubt it.
But the decay part
bigger
was the equivalent of everyone in Oregon driving their car for 100 years.
Yeah.
And we salvaged nothing out of that whole thing. Mm. And I was wondering why, I guess I don't understand why we're not salvaging it and why we aren't reforesting, reforestation. So, but that's a federal issue because those are probably federal lands.
Right. Yeah. 100%.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, we could actually take you out to spots on the ground where we could look up property line and look at the difference between salvage and reforestation on the private side and on the federal side. Again, the different set of prescriptions and requirements and regulations on the federal side. We know, and we certainly have a history in Oregon on non-federal land, thinking about the Tillamook burn of salvage, of reforestation. It's a part of the tradition.
anyone who's keeping score on the federal government, this is brought to you by their forest management policy. excuse me, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it was badly needed. I was wondering if you have any idea of how much private and public property, for example, tree farms, fences, animals, buildings, et cetera, have been lost in the last 10 to 15 years from forest fires in Oregon, cost-wise.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, I don't have a specific number that looks at what that damage has been. We know that those, I mean, that's kind of a collateral damage associated with firefighting. I don't have that number. In fact, I'm not sure that we actually will track that. We have some broader look at damage assessments that we've done on specific large fires in the past, but on a season by season basis, the financial statistics that we're tracking really have to do with cost expenditures as opposed to damage.
Please.
It might help the public to understand exactly what kind of impact this has economically on the state of Oregon if we could keep track, and there will hopefully be a bill coming that way to help you guys inform the public as to the damage done by these fires. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And gentlemen, while we're on the subject of fire, would you just briefly tell the committee what your theory is on an initial attack of when a fire breaks out?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, the initial attack is, this is the kind of the golden hour, our ability to get ahead of the situation. In Oregon, our track record is our goal is to have 97% of all of our fires controlled at less than 10 acres. And as Ken had said, the best dollar that we spend is really a dollar in prevention and in keeping those fires small. We know that when fires go over the hill, they can be extremely expensive. So our whole approach, from our culture, the way we're equipped, our statutory guidance is around attacking fire when they're small. And we have about 1,000 fires a year, and you don't hear about most of them. It's the men and women on the ground who are getting those fires out. It's a critical part of getting the job done. And one of the things about 2050 is that it actually provides some additional resources, largely air resources, to strengthen our ability to do effective initial attack.
And would you please let the public know when a major fire does break out, who in the department is called upon to assist in those efforts?
When a fire breaks out, we certainly do, particularly in fires that are close into populated areas, telling that story and making sure the folks understand that that's part of responding to the fires.
Thank you very much. And I'm assuming that it's an all hands on deck if and when we have a major fire outbreak.
It is indeed. And in fact, to that point, all of us in the Department of Forestry, regardless of our what business, what different division that we're in, we all have in our job description that we're part of the fire organization. We refer to it as the militia. I mean, if you are an office administrator in Tillamook, or if you are a hydrologist, or if you're in the fire business, when the fire bell rings, you're part of the fire organization. We spend time during the year training and equipping folks so that they're ready to do that. And again, that's a critical part of our culture.
Thank you very much. Representative Vice Chair McEwen.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you, first of all, for crafting this bill and coming today with it. I think it's a very important bill. Personally, I was down at Agnes the day the Biscuit Fire blew up. I have some amazing photographs of that first smoke plume that went up, and we lived with that fire for months on the ground, very close to where we spend a lot of time, and it was a heroic effort. It was a devastating event, and just firsthand, the work that people did was amazing, and we certainly want to avoid those from occurring again, and I appreciate what you're trying to do here today, so thank you so much for your effort.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you.
Anything else from our committee? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Thank you for your testimony and the tremendous job that you do in saving our forests and the state from catastrophic fire. Appreciate that very much.
I hope we aren't visiting a department when a fire breaks out because we may be on the front line.
That's
maybe a part of our job description too. We don't know.
Folks, we're going to stand at ease here just for a second.
I was thinking about it.
There we go.
To go order ready, and they said if you get the go order generator.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Jim Geisinger and Lyle DeFreeze. And gentlemen, if there's anyone else that you would like to have come up with you, that would be fine as well. And why don't I ask up to John Breeze, please? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group that represents almost 1,000 businesses in the state of Oregon that are directly or indirectly involved in the logging industry. We provide a variety of services to the forest sector, including firefighting, and many of our members are also owners of forest land. So we have a direct interest in House Bill 2050, and we're here to support it with a lot of enthusiasm. Our association participated in the Board of Forestry's Fire Funding Committee in 2012. This is the committee that developed a consensus proposal, which is reflected in this bill. And to cut to the chase and keep my testimony very brief, we support this bill for four key reasons. One is it does increase the investment in initial attack, and as you heard from the previous panel, it's probably the most effective way to mitigate the size and severity of forest fire. Fires. Secondly, it reallocates firefighting resources in a very quick way to situations that have predicted high severity. Number three, and very important to landowners, it does reinstitute the balance of 50-50 shared responsibility that was intended by the legislature between landowners and the state for forest firefighting expenses. And lastly, it does provide some needed relief on the east side with firefighting assistance to keep those forests productive and healthy for future uses. And that, in a nutshell, is the reasons that we support this bill and would hope that you would too. Thank you.
Tremendous. Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to our committee.
Morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to for our hearing here. My name is Lyle DeFreeze, and I'm in support of House Bill 2050, the Wildfire Protection Act. My family owns a ranch in northeastern Oregon in Baker County, a place in a valley called Sumter, and we have on the ranch we have 1,200 acres of timber. Land. And I might say at this point, I am familiar with catastrophic fire because the ranch lost almost 500 acres in 1986 to such a fire. We actively manage the forest. It's a well-maintained forest and very productive as far as the east side forest is concerned. I am also the president of the Baker County Private Woodlands Association, which is a chapter of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Controlling fire costs by having adequate resources is really the key to minimizing a catastrophic fire. And I believe this, if House Bill 2050 is implemented, it'll do just that. The present fire patrol assessment is a burden on the private landowners of eastern Oregon who grow trees that grow at a very slow rate. One of my ranch's tax lots for this last year of 893 acres was $1,555, or 94% of the total tax burden that was on that piece of property. So it's very important for us to try and minimize that fire patrol assessment. For a sustainable forest in Eastern Oregon, there must be an economic incentive to own the land. Several of my neighbors find their monetary returns evaporating, and they are selling their lands for home sites or for hunting areas. New landowners are quite often absentee owners that believe that mistakenly that unmanaged land is the best for the environment and for the wildlife. I think the public prefers a forest that is aesthetically pleasing with healthy trees, clean water, abundant and variable varied wildlife, healthy forages, and clean air. And if the public expects benefits from the valuable resources that private lands provide, then the cost of protection from large fires should be shared by all citizens. In House Bill 2050, I believe, if it's implemented, we'll give the department resources to keep firefighting costs down by minimizing the size of catastrophic fires in Eastern Oregon. It also addresses the fire patrol assessment while allowing landowners to pay their fair share of the fire patrol assessment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. DeFreeze. We appreciate your statement. I think you probably win the award today for the longest distance traveled to come share your story with us, and we certainly appreciate that and your good stewardship of the land over there. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm John Breeze from Prineville, Oregon. It's in Cook County. Our representative is Mike McLean, and our senator is Doug Whitsitt. So I'm pleased to come. It's a long ways for a short distance, but it's important. This is an important bill for us. We're in the middle of what is referred to as the non-productive side of the state, but when you think about it, Oregon has some of the most productive forest land in the world, and so when we're talking about non-productive, that doesn't mean that we're not intense and that we don't use our forest land to the best advantage it can have. Our family's been ranching for over 100 years in that spot, and I'd like it to. Anyway, our goal is to give the next generation, our family, the potential to ranch and extend that the next 100 years. The fire patrol assessments are getting out of hand. They're going up at a steeper rate than we can handle. 90% of our tax is fire patrol, and the rates are going up. And as you know, it's called an assessment. It's a tax, but it's not capped. So it's whatever it takes for the whatever we had for the last year, then is what it takes to do the next year. And we've been very lucky in our district, Central Oregon District, to have dodged the bullet. So our tax rate is still going up, but not at an extreme rate. And this bill is one of those bills that, for honest people on the ground, it gets more people there faster, and so that we can get those fires caught soon. We have three little fire trucks. And we use those, but it's good to have a backup when you have your 1956 pumper running around there. It's good to have 20-year-olds running around in a nice thing that works really well and can get there maybe not as fast as we are because we're there. And they have to travel, but but that's the main part of that bill for us. That when you saw that picture of the $1 million, it really doesn't do a whole lot for our assessment, but it helps that cap. It keeps the level from going so directly fast. And then the department's getting smarter and smarter about knowing when we're going to have a big fire. We can have a fire anytime during the fire season, but there are those special times during the year when we're going to have a fire, and it's going to happen sometime on someplace in southwestern Oregon, clear through the blues in far eastern Oregon, and they're getting smart about knowing where to put that extra equipment, and this bill is going to be able to put maybe. We hope they can put that extra severity right where it's needed at the time, so it can bolster us. And if they can catch some of those fires, it would be great. I mean, we put our whole career into developing a forest that we can manage and log sustainably, and it can be wiped out in a flash, and so the risk is great, and I'm hopeful that you can support this bill. And it's not perfect; it's a compromise. When they brought this bill, and we, Oswa Small Woodlands has tried to promote this, and I'm grateful that the Department of Forestry has brought it together. It's not perfect, but it's the best I think that we could put together. Thank you for your support.
Thank you very, very much for your support as well, and your very fine stewardship of the land. It's palpable from your statements, and you can just feel really the care that you take for the lands that you own and the forests that you manage, as well as your ranches. Thank you so much for the considerable distance that you traveled as well, Mr. Brees. Before I let the panel go, Jim, I'm sure your members also share a significant amount of resources in firefighting from time to time. Just briefly let us know some of the things that are used in that effort.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we typically have contracts with the state to provide equipment on fires, and as long as you have given me the opportunity, I would like to say that the state of Oregon is probably the most efficient, effective firefighting operation in the United States of America.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to amend this bill to turn over all of the federal lands to the state of Oregon,
we're working on that, Jim. We're working on that.
Well, the dash one.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you so very, very, very much. Continue your great job of stewardship. Next, please, Russell Hoflick. And let's see here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Witt, Vice Chairs, Member of the Committee. I'm Russ Hoflick. I'm the Oregon Director of the Nature Conservancy. It's an honor to be here today. I do want to reiterate the point that was just taken. We are so fortunate in the state of Oregon to have in ODF truly the most effective firefighting force in the nation. The challenge that we have in front of us today, if you look at the forest condition in our state, you're talking about green wood, black wood. You're talking about the challenges of our state. I want to give you some context. The forest initiative that is in front of you to make sure that we have early detection, rapid response is absolutely critical. It's critical to the Nature Conservancy. It's critical to our nation. It's critical to the wealth of our state. It's critical from a perspective of getting the people in eastern Oregon, where one out of five are in poverty. 10.8% unemployment is standing as a challenge for the state of Oregon. We need to put these people back to work, but it's absolutely critical that ODF has the ability to do the most rapid response to to the lightning strikes that are hitting our state. The technology is advancing rapidly. Their ability to be able to get out and hit the fires, we just need that. The standing wealth is extraordinary. There's other people in the room working in a united fashion under the governor's Federal Forest Land Implementation Work Group to try to find a way to get that excess standing wood out of the forest. Historically, go back about 1950, you had in eastern Oregon, I'll focus on particular in southern Oregon, about 75 trees per acre, typical background rate. Today we have in excess, in some cases, up to 1,500 trees per acre. That's standing wealth. It's a standing opportunity for all of us. We could take that wood out, but we need ODF to have the capacity until we get that wood out to put the fires out. To the question of doing salvage versus greenwood, I take the greenwood and the wealth that is there any day over the salvage lumber. We could bring that to the mills. We could make a profit for our state. We could put people back to work in a very predictable way. We need to build resiliency into the forest. That's one of our biggest challenges. But getting ODF the equipment they need, the technology advancements to be able to hit the fires quickly while we solve that bigger problem is absolutely in your hands, and I urge you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, anything? Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of hit on something there when it comes to salvage of our resources. When you were talking about 1,500 trees per acre, I've heard, 500 to 1,500. I've heard that pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. But what I've also heard that the capacity for those trees to function is so diminished that the 50 to 70 trees per acre did a superior job to the 500 to 1,500 trees per acre as for producing of oxygen.
You are absolutely right. We have found evidence site after site, and when we start treating and clearing back to historic rates, it will only take 3 years to recover the biomass that you take out. The healthier, resilient forests are growing at extraordinary rates when they don't compete for water or sunlight, let alone reduction of the risk to the state and to the nation and to our firefighters. We've got to be able to do the early detection, rapid response, and then we will be able to get in, but we have to be able to treat and remove that excess standing wealth that we've all inherited.
Thank you very, very much for your comments.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Appreciate your help.
Thank you. Next, please, I'd like to call up Scott Hansen and Christina McNitt. To both, all of you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Scott Hansen. I'm a lifelong Oregonian, a resident of Clackamas County, and a small woodland owner for over 30 years. I want to actively support House Bill 2050, the Wildfire Protection Act. I think it has a lot of good ideas in it. I do. Also, in my background, I'm the past president of Clackamas County Farm Forestry Association. I'm current president-elect of Oregon Small Woodland Association. So, fires impact the safety of all of us, and it's a tremendous asset. I think we all agree to that, the trees. And what I gather from here this morning is we're a big team here, and we're all part of this in protecting this valuable asset. I don't want to reiterate, I've submitted my testimony, I don't want to reiterate what other folks have said, but I do want to say one thing on this additional monies that we're going to spend up front to try to get these fires when they're very small. I think it makes a tremendous amount of sense to do it, to approach it that way, and I think that will then save us money for the state in total. So that's basically it, my testimony.
Scott, thank you very much.
Sure.
Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Christina McNitt with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and with me is Milt Moran. He's the former president of the Lynn Forest Protective Association, and he works with Cascade Consulting out of Sweet Home. I'm just going to take the opportunity to kind of speak off the cuff a little bit and try to answer some of the questions that have come up rather than delve into the details of the bill, which I think you've already heard fairly in depth. But this is, to coin your phrase, Chairman Witt, an important bill. And it's not the first time that Oregon Forest Industries Council has worked on trying to come to this elusive equity issue around the actual cost of high fire suppression. It is, however, unusual to have this room full of people representing small woodlands, the industrial landowners, the cattlemen, Farm Bureau, the loggers. I mean, it's just tremendous. And on top of that, to be an agency pre-session filed bill and to be contemplated in the governor's balanced budget is very exciting. It reflects a lot of work by stakeholders and leadership by the Department of Forestry to get to this point. What I would like to talk about a little bit, Representative Krieger, maybe to your question, fire is tremendously expensive for landowners, but what we're talking about here really only captures the cost of suppressing the fire. What we're not talking about is the cost of loss in resources, in wildlife habitat, in stream and water quality, in air quality. All of those are less tangible, except for the resource loss values that Oregonians consider important. What this bill really gets at is the equity of who pays for the cost of fire suppression. That's it. And I also want to remind you, I've had the opportunity to meet with most of you, but the insurance policy that we continually talk about is not an insurance policy for our landowners and their trees. There's no such insurance policy on the market. Rather, landowners are paying half of the cost of securing that unique insurance policy to protect the general fund in case that we had some absolutely runaway, terrible fire year like, say, California. So really, this insurance is to protect the general fund. The taxes that the landowners pay for their protection, you heard from Mr. DeFreeze, are huge, and in Eastern Oregon, in some cases, greatly outweigh the taxes paid for even for their local school districts. But embedded in these payments come a fee for an improved lot, a structure fee, an annual per acre fee for Eastern Oregon forest land, a different rate for Western Oregon forest land, a different rate for grazing land, a harvest tax rate, and then there's also the in-kind resources that landowners provide and have ready to bring to a fire in the event that something occurs. In my testimony that I passed out, I will just point you to the one graph on the front page that talks about the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is made up of those taxes that I just enumerated. And since 1993, the landowners have paid $156.8 million in fire suppression for the state, relative to the general fund portion of that of $34.1 million. So rather than 50-50, which was the intent of revising this program, we're really at 82-18. The last thing I just want to point out before I turn this to Milton and move on is that we have had some experience with the SPA, which is what we call the special purpose appropriation that the general fund makes to allow the department to secure and pre-position mostly air-type tankers and special equipment to help them catch these fires quickly at initial attack. Before Oregon had the SPA resources, I have some statistics for you versus after we started securing the SPA resources, and I think they're dramatic, and I think that it lends strength to our philosophy around this bill, which is enhancing those resources. Before SPA, the average number of fires per year was 1,050. And after SPA, the average number was 1,124, so an increase of 74 fires. There's nothing the SPA did to affect that. That just happened to be the statistic. But when you look at the average number of acres before SPA resources were available, the average number of acres burned up were 30,811 acres versus post-SPA, in today's world, 17,805 acres. So that's a reduction of 42%. That right there proves some effectiveness. The average suppression cost during the same time for pre-spa, the pre-spa world, was $12.5 million a year versus today $8.1 million, so a reduction of 35%. So with that, I'm going to turn the baton over to Milt. Appreciate very much this committee considering the bill. We're supportive of the dash, I think they're one, amendments, and moving this on for further discussion in Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Milt Moran. I work for Cascade Timber Consulting Sweet Home. I've been there my entire career since 1973, so I do the math. It's been a while. I've been very fortunate to work on the Hill Timber property whose lands we manage and sort of have the license to treat it like it's my own, which I feel very, very fortunate in this world of industry. This group that's been working for the last year, couple years, has been a very, very diverse group of folks. And putting this thing together, the really big issue that I've found that I can hang my hat on is those severity resources. And one thing that, you know, it's a lot has been talked about how these severity resources are going to be available for those areas with high fire-prone occurrences. And that's going to happen. But as representing a landowner, 145,000 acres on the west slope of the Cascades, we're very fortunate. We do have fires, and they can be very large. But what I like about this severity resource is that they're going to be available for us also. It's not just going to be the east side folks. A lot of times fire seasons sort of start over on the east side and then migrate to the west side as the summer goes along. And so those resources will also be available for us. Talk a little bit about what Jim Geisinger had talked about those extra resources. Our company, we have a very large investment besides our Forest Patrol assessment, pretty sizable. We also own some significant firefighting equipment, and we have contractors, our logging contractors, that are those AOL members that Jim talked about, and they have a lot of equipment.
Yep.
And we bring that in kind in millions of dollars every year with training, communications, lots of equipment, and so it's really big on the private landowner's part. Lots been said already this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you folks this morning. This is a really, really good bill, and good bills need to pass. So thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Certainly appreciate all of your comments. It was excellent testimony. Do we have any questions for this panel? Thank you again very, very much. Next, please, I'd like to call up Ian Tollison and Jim Welch. Gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ian Tollison, Oregon Farm Bureau. Probably not much more I can add to the thorough testimony that was given today. Our members are very interested in seeing this policy pass. I think it's good policy, and it is an investment that you will see a good return in, and would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, and committee members, Jim Welch, representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. We appreciate the process that brought this change in formula. We were very concerned because of the rates and assessments that we were paying. Mm-hmm. I remember one of our past presidents making the comment, can we change something in the future here? Are we going to have an opportunity? Because my assessments for fire protection are higher than what I'm paying for my county property taxes. And so we heard more and more from some other individuals that are ranching over there, and they're forest landowners also. And so this opportunity came along. The Board of Forestry heard our plea, and so did the department. And so we were asked to sit at the table. We participated. You've heard a lot of great things about this. This formula will protect not only the general fund, it will protect our members and some of lower value grazing land. And we will get, because of this formula, because of their action, their first strike approach, we believe we will get some reduction, hopefully, in the future for not only the general fund, but for our private dollars and our assessments. And that's it in a nutshell, and we thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate your support. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify today on House Bill 2050? I'm not seeing anyone. Before I close the public hearing, I would just like to note that we have heard from a lot of folks from the private sector who are woodland owners, who are willing participants in sharing the costs of fighting fire in the state, who are willing to come to the table and pay half of the costs, and then on top of that, bring many of the firefighting resources that our state depends on to fight fires across our state. That these folks do this not only willingly, but they do it in the interest not only of themselves, but the rest of the public here in our state. They do this job as well as anyone, and they do this job because it's the right thing. And I think that's what helps distinguish our firefighting program in this state and makes us one of the best states in the nation. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. And hold on here just a sec. And I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2050. And I would recognize, please, Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/18/13 for House Bill 2050.
Vice Chair McEwen moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated February 18th, 2013. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, I move with pleasure House Bill 2050 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 2050 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to that motion? So ordered. Thank you very, very much, committee members. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2050. Next up, we have, we're going to change a little bit here. We're going to shift to mining with House Bill 2248. Beth, would you please tell us about that bill? I'll open the public hearing. House Bill 2248.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2248 would amend statutes related to mineral mining to encompass additional types of mining and also makes conforming amendments.
Thank you very much. And we have a number of people signed up for this bill. Call up, please, Gary Lynch. All right, bring up, come on up, everyone. All of you would like to testify, please. Come on up. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology. Specifically, I administer the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. We have brought to you today a bill that hopefully will clarify issues that we are rapidly facing in Oregon with an increase in some of the mining sectors. Currently, base and precious metals, when I say base and precious metals, base metals, it's an old term used in the mining industry. That's typically lead, zinc, copper, some of those type of things. Precious metals most typically are gold, silver, and platinum. Currently, the base and precious metal mining are regulated by two different statutory provisions, which are the chemical process mining and the non-aggregate mineral statutes. They overlap. As you will hear from our contact attorney, Larry Knutson, who's going to get in more of the specifics of this, we need to fairly and effectively regulate base and precious metal mining. We need to put the regulations into one silo so that we avoid having an applicant needing two permits from Dagami for the same supposed ore body. Clearly, chemical process mining statutes and rules are a far better regulatory tool than the non-aggregate mineral division, because they were drafted specifically to deal with the mining of the targeted minerals. The non-aggregate minerals statutes were woven together in a patchwork quilt fashion. I think it's important to point out what this bill doesn't do, and that is this bill would not affect aggregate mining. It would not affect mining of industrial minerals. It would not affect placer mining. This bill, this bill is supported by the regulated community. To date, we have identified no opposition. That's not to say there isn't some. Hopefully today we'll make clear up any of those inconsistencies if there are, or concerns if there are any. And with that, I'd like to have Larry Knutson get into the details of what we're proposing, because it can be confusing at times.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Larry Knutson. I'm an assistant attorney general. I've been counsel for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries for many years. I have provided written testimony and provided that to your staff, so I'm just going to summarize that. But basically, I'm testifying on behalf of Dogami in support of House Bill 2244. The bill has one principal purpose, and that's to change the state mine or state permitting system for mines for metal-bearing ore, that where the ore is excavated and crushed and processed using a system called froth flotation. Basically, there are three types of processing that are used for metal mining. One is a gravity separation method, which is just as it sounds. You use gravity separate the ore. Heavy metal ore tends to be heavier than the materials it's associated with, so you can crush that and use air or water to separate the components. A second method is froth flotation, and I'm not an expert on this. If you've got detailed questions, you can ask Mr. Lynch. But basically, the crushed ore is mixed with water and surfactants, and the precious metals are precipitated out. I guess that would be accurate. Floated out. The third method is chemical mining or chemical leaching, where cyanide or acid is mixed with the crushed ore, and that cyanide or acid actually leaches out the metals, and then they are recovered from the leachate. As Mr. Lynch mentioned, there are presently two regulatory systems for mining in the state, and they kind of represent the two extremes you might think of the regulatory spectrum. There is a basic regulatory system that's used for aggregate and sand and gravel, and that same system with a few modifications is also used for coal and for all metal mining. That, and then there's a newer process that was adopted in 1991 for chemical process mines, and I'll get into both of those in some detail. But the older permitting process is very rudimentary. Essentially, first of all, there's a number of exceptions for small-scale mining, but for those mines that are covered, the applicant files an application, a mine operating plan, and reclamation plan. That's measured to get some standards that are in rule. The application is circulated to state and federal agencies. The department determines the proper amount of the reclamation bond, and once that bond is posted, the permit is issued for the mine, and the mine has essentially a permit to operate for the life of the mine. And Dogami can make changes unilaterally only in a few narrow circumstances. This process does not provide for public input, and it does not provide for any kind of in-depth environmental analysis of the attributes of the mine or the potential of the mine to affect other issues. This more modern chemical process mining statute, we call it the consolidated mining permitting process, and I'll get into the reasons for that in a second, but it was adopted in 1991 specifically to address chemical process mining. And it has a very robust public participation component to it. It also has a very fact-forward process where early on in the process, the applicant and the agencies are required to develop the necessary factual basis for the permitting. And it has a process for evaluating those impacts that's similar to the NEPA process in the federal government or the process that's used for energy facility siting here in the state. And so that information is then used to determine whether or not you've got a complete application to proceed with permitting. A key component of this 1991 statute is that it requires cooperation of all the state agencies that have an impact or a role, regulatory role, in permitting mining. For example, Water Resources Department, DEQ, ODFW all often have roles in the permitting process, and it requires those all to be consolidated, both in terms of developing the necessary information for the application and in terms of coordinating the conditions that may be imposed upon the permit when it is issued. There are also mechanisms for coordinating with local governments and with federal agencies, because often with metal mining, there is a federal overlay that's rather substantial. So that is the so-called chemical process or consolidated permitting process that we use now for those mines. And the proposal is to bring those mines using the froth flotation into that chemical process mining or consolidated permitting process. The bill itself is relatively long and may appear complicated, but most of those provisions are just what you would think of as conforming amendments. The basic process here is to delete the definition of chemical process mining and substitute for it a definition of mining operations that includes all mines except those using only gravity separation. There's also a provision that existed before and that's maintained that exempts placer mining. The other important substantive provision in the bill is a fee provision, and essentially what that does is provide somewhat higher base fees up front and clarifies the system for recovering costs from the applicant. Under the consolidated mining permitting process, the applicant is responsible for the reasonable costs of the permitting process. But when the statutes were put together back in 1991, the cost recovery provisions did not occur until fairly late into the process. The state agencies that are involved with doing this often don't have the money to front that those initial costs. So the idea is to provide for a slightly larger bump up front and to clarify when those costs can be recovered. A final provision in the bill eliminates some artificial caps that existed in these special provisions that applied to metal and coal mines that are covered under the basic process, and those caps are now unrealistic, so we would like to have those removed. And then the rest of the bill is basically conforming the statutes to those principles. We have identified two minor issues that we may need to file or request, I should say, -1 amendments, and we'll bring those back at a subsequent work session. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if anybody has them.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said about the amendments.
That they're going to be bringing some -2 amendments, and they're not ready yet.
Okay.
With that, Representative Whitsett, please.
I have several questions, if I may. Could you confirm that the renewal fee for operating permits will be increased from $456 to $2,500?
Uh, Chair Witt and Representative Witt said, yes, that is correct. Although, in reality, it probably doesn't represent an increase in the fees because, as I mentioned earlier, the applicant is responsible for cost recovery of the agency fees. Typically, those fees are going to be much larger than either amount. So it's basically making sure that the fee amounts are paid earlier in the process.
Please.
The inspection fee would be raised from a maximum of $200 to $1,200. Same. I'm just going through some of your fee. Notice of intent to submit a consolidated application fee increased from $600 to $1,260. And then I have a question. Expenses shall be paid no longer just by applicant, but also by prospective applicant. And so I was wondering, what is an applicant versus a prospective applicant?
Chair Witt, Representative Witt said, first of all, yes, I think you're correct as to those fee increases. The reason for the addition of the prospective applicant and to the language is because the way the consolidated permit process is established, a company interested in mining first files a notice of intent to mine, and the filing of that notice of intent to mine triggers a pre-application process that includes collecting the necessary baseline data and analyzing that data, or I should say collecting it and verifying that data. And at that time, you don't really have an applicant. You only have a prospective applicant. And so the bill, or I should say the statutes as they were enacted in 1991, covered all of those costs, but had the first payments coming in when the application was filed by the applicant. Under this provision, the payments will come earlier when you have a prospective applicant.
Okay, I follow up. Could you describe what, quote, affected public bodies means? Does this allow for a third party people to make complaints potentially about proposed mining activities?
Representative Witt and Representative Witt said this bill and the existing bill do not have any citizen suit provisions or anything that would expand the rights of parties to challenge a permit. There are robust provisions in the consolidated application process for the public to comment and for Dogami to respond to those comments, but they do not create legal rights to stop or change a operation.
Okay, I have one last one.
That's fine.
Okay,
please feel free.
This is for Mr. Lynch or Dr. Lynch. Does Dogami have an estimate of the value of known mineral reserves in Oregon at approximately present time? And first I'll let you answer that.
Chair Witt and Representative Witsit, where do I begin? Could you phrase that question real quick?
Do you have any idea of the known value of the mineral commodities in the state?
The total value of minerals in Oregon is unestimable, really. Dr. McConnell, our state geologist, might be able to answer that better than I. But typically, minerals are found by, unlike trees and vegetation, they're underground. They're not easily counted. So we don't have a value or an estimate of what's in the ground.
Okay.
Statewide.
Right. So I would assume that could be in the billions. And I'm just wondering, will this bill make extracting those invaluable resources harder or easier for people in the state of Oregon? I mean, that's what we need to determine here, I
think. Chair, Representative Witsit, we think this is a far more responsible process. What we want to keep clear here is, you know, there's a section of folks that, whether it's placer mining, small-scale placer mining, or even large-scale placer mining, that have a role to play in the process. They typically are not going to be affected. It's safe to say they're really not going to be affected by this. These bills target large commercial enterprises that you see. We don't have any currently in Oregon. We have somebody going through the process right now, and you may hear from them later. But so from that standpoint, I hope that helps. I don't know if I made that clear enough.
I guess you don't know if it's going to make it harder or easier for. I'm looking for the revenue stream to the state that large corporations that may be able to mine. If it's harder for them to mine, there's less revenue coming into the state. So,
Chair Witt and Representative Witt, these rules certainly do target the larger operators. If it's not fair and effective regulation, then we're not doing our job. So. And the concern is making sure we differentiate between the large chemical process mines and large-scale mines, and not burden the smaller miners who don't have the contamination scenarios that some of these large operations can have. And they can effectively deal with them, and the rules and regulations can effectively deal with them. And so we're trying to get that aligned so that it is fair and that and it is effective.
Mr. Knudsen.
If I may, Chair Witt and Representative Witt, one of the things that I failed to cover when I was discussing the consolidated permitting process, which I should have, is that I can't answer the direct question if it will cost more or less, but the consolidated permitting process was carefully designed by industry. It was a compromise bill that was designed essentially to front load information, but at the same time ensure that permitting would actually happen and would happen faster or more predictably. And so it includes provisions that once the application is complete, it puts the state agencies on essentially a one-year glide path in order to get the permit issued. It also has provisions for a consolidated contested case and direct appeals to the Supreme Court, all with the notion that sort of the quid pro quo for getting more information, requiring more upfront, was that the companies would have more security, that they wouldn't get caught in a catch-22 situation where there could be inconsistent permit conditions, or where other agencies might not move as quickly. And so that was sort of the quid pro quo. We'll do more up front, but we'll get you a faster process to get through to ultimately having a permit and being able to mine.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I appreciate your comments, Representative Witsit, and to your comment, your most recent comment, I'm very grateful for the intent to put maybe, I guess I would call it a time certain on a permitting process through your agency. I think it's very important that across the state we continue to attempt to allow businesses who want to come in a framework of a business cycle getting something done in a timely manner. So I'm very grateful for your intent there. I have a couple of kind of detailed questions on the bill, and these may be things you intend to address in your Dash 1 amendment. I'll throw them out, and if you want to come back with them at a later time, that's fine. One of them has to do with page 14, line 17. It's how you're defining a ton of ore. Is this just the valuable component, or does it include the overburden or non-valuable mineral that's returned to the pit? I don't know if that's something that needs to be clarified potentially. On page 12, line 8, how does this interact with MSHA, who's the regulatory agency for health and safety at the mine sites? And on page 9, line 35, it has to do with a third-party contractor is hired. A question came to me about how this can become a significant cost to the applicant and who manages that. So if those are things that you could clarify for me at some point, that would be helpful.
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, I would like to take the time, and we'll get back to you with that. The one, the simplest one to answer, the page 12, line 8, Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, they regulate the mining that occurs within the permit boundary from a safety standpoint, not an environmental standpoint. So we'll
Great. Thank
enhance
you.
That.
I'm sorry, these just came to me, so I'm That I'm not as familiar with this as I might have been had I been here for a little bit longer. So I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, committee members? Just to... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Thompson.
I was late. Since most of our mines are not in urban areas, does this change encourage or stifle job development in rural Oregon?
Chair Witt, Representative Thompson, again, we're talking about a very, very, we don't even have one of these operations in the state right now, so they are rare. But typically where they're going to happen is in rural Oregon. The proposal we have in front of us to date is 17 miles south of Vail.
Rural.
Yeah, that's
very rural. That counts.
And mining, you don't, mining in urban areas just doesn't occur at this scale.
Metal mining,
yes.
Gentlemen, just so that I'm trying to get some sideboards around the scope of this bill, perhaps for the public as much as for our committee's benefits. First of all, are there any coal mines in Oregon today, and do you anticipate any in the foreseeable future?
Chair Witt, no, and we don't have large coal reserves.
Okay. And next, would this bill be determining whether it's appropriate public policy or not to have open pit mines, heap leach mining, suction dredge mining, or is this more a regulatory bill for the mining that already occurs in our state?
This bill is really trying to deal with an issue that really it sounds like it's size, but again, what we're talking about right now, we are facing we're working with a company that's proposing to mine estimated 800,000 to 1.4 million ounces of gold. They could be in a very unusual position if they were to use cyanide recovery, and I don't mean the open pit type. This would apply to open pit, but we don't have any proposals there. What we have is an underground proposal. And they could be caught in a situation where as long as they were using the cyanide recovery process, which is contained, they would be under one set of rules. If they use froth flotation, they would be on another set of rules that we think is arcane and archaic. What we're trying to do is say, look, that's not fair. They can't be put under two different processes for the same ore body. And what we're saying is we're going to move this froth flotation, which into the chemical process mine. For both sites, these are large mines. We're talking millions of ounces, and it is very sophisticated and complex permitting activity. It's well underway. We made great strides back in 91 on the chemical process side. We didn't quite hit we never fixed Division 35 because we had no activity in that area. And so it has sat there senescent. And then we look at it now and we have this dilemma, which we're trying to fix with this bill, that would say it's frost flotation at the scale we're talking about in these mines goes into Division 37 chemical process mining. So it is a clarification to not put somebody in double jeopardy of trying to solve the dual permit requirements. Does that help?
I think it helps tremendously. It's very specific. It deals with a specific application, and this is not the all-encompassing public policy of mining in the state of Oregon.
If I might, Chair Witt, it's probably worth pointing out that Dogami's jurisdiction does not extend to suction dredge mining that occurs below the high water line.
Good point.
That is regulated by other agencies.
Right.
Dogami does regulate larger placer mines that would occur above the high water mark.
Uh-huh.
But again, most of those, first of all, they're exempt from this bill, and second, they wouldn't tend to be using chemical process mining or flotation. So,
very good. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And for helping us set the sideboards on this bill. I'd like to call up next, please, Donald Esch, Samuel Seth, and Trevor Sheffield, please. Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
Welcome. Please determine your order of testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Witt. I'm Don Esch, and I believe Sam will be testifying next, then Trevor over here will be the last one to testify.
Very good.
First off, I'd like to show my appreciation of having the opportunity to talk to Mr. Chair Witt and also the other members of the committee. This is my first time of doing this, so I might be a little bit nervous, but I'm going to give it my best shot anyway. Okay, good morning, Chair Representative Mr. Witt and members of the committee for inviting me to testify. I am Don Esch, and a business owner, small business owner, a retired firefighter of over 36 years in the fire service. And I really did enjoy the listening to the Forest Service people and also the opposition for and against them. I've been on some of those fires. In fact, some of my claims have also been located on those fires. I won't go into that. But anyway, I oppose House Bill 2248 specifically and the amendments to it. And what I handed out, this is just my short bulletin presentation, but all the information plus quite a bit more additional information has been handed out in my full written testimony to you folks, so you can all take a chance, take a look at it, and I'd be glad to answer any of your questions for that. Okay, this bill appears originally been written to address issues concerning large-scale mining using chemical processing such as the arsenic gold mining process. As it has been admitted, it will affect all other types of mining in Oregon, including the small-scale miner, recreational miners, even tourists who come here just to do a little bit of gold panning. Although it has been stated it does not affect placer mining, as written, it appears that it does. The principle of specific gravity, using water to separate heavy minerals by the use of water or air, that is the primary means that we use to recover, you know, gold, silver, platinum, and even a lot of our gemstones, such as Oregon State Rock or State Gem, the Sunstone. And we do not use any means of chemical processing in our suction dredge operations. As a business owner that does small scaling and others, the ability to do so would be destroyed and cause a loss of $16 million to Oregon's economy, over $6.9 million to the miners' income. And according to the National Mining Association 2010 report, the Oregon mining industry provided a total of, in 2010, over 17,000 jobs, over $1.5 billion was generated by state's mining industry. The income and payroll taxes from Oregon payrolls, including federal, state, and local, and FICA, totaled nearly $322 million. This bill, and also I did provide you a copy of that NMA report for you. The mining association there, what they do is basically compile information about mining industries and other incomes that are produced by each of our states. If this bill should go through, as has been admitted, it could cause a loss of money supporting our local businesses, lose an income source that I was hoping to supplement my income with, a loss of taxes I pay for doing my business, could put me out of business. I request, therefore, of you to take a very close look at this bill and reject it as it has been admitted. Thank you, Chair Mr. Witt and the committee members, for this opportunity to testify, and I'll be glad to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Representative Mr. Witt and committee members. My name is Samuel Seth. I live in Kaiser. I'm representing myself today. I'm a small-scale independent placer gold miner. I operate small suction dredges. I oppose HB 2248 as it is currently written. My mining operations support my college education, and it would certainly hinder my ability to attend college if I did not have this source of income. The new fees and permitting processes that would be established for my interpretation of this bill as proposed, they would be prohibitively expensive and would destroy the source of income for me. There appears to be no exemption for placer mining, and there's also an exemption for operations moving less than 5,000 cubic yards of material per year. My mining activities depend on low overhead costs, and I would not be able to afford the thousands of dollars of extra fees and on-site inspections that would be imposed upon me by this bill. The existing regulations appear to regulate operations that move 5,000 cubic yards or more per year and use chemical processing. My operations move less than 25 cubic yards of material per year, and I never use chemical processing in any of my operations. It defies logic and common sense to pass legislation that would lump these vastly different operations together and regulate them in the same way with the same fee structure. The scope of the bill seems to be vague, and I worry that I may be affected by this. The bill would amend current law, and it removes the exemption for 5,000 cubic yards or less, as I said before, and specific gravity separation would be put on the same level as chemical separation. Furthermore, HB 2248 would place what seems to be an unacceptable financial burden on the state of Oregon through the increased permit review processes and on-site inspections by third-party contractors. This bill would destroy the livelihood of many Oregonians that engage in small-scale mining, and a large source of income for me would be destroyed as well. I respectfully urge you all to closely examine this bill and not allow it to ruin the lives of your fellow Oregonians. If this bill is to be passed, there must be an exemption for placer mining specifically and an exemption for specific gravity separation like we small-scale placer miners use. Thank you, Chair Representative Mr. Witt and committee members, for giving me this opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Representative Mr. Witt and committee. I am Trevor Sheffield from Albany, and I'm representing myself. I oppose House Bill 2248 and specifically the additions and subtractions to it. As written, it will make suction mining just about impossible for me, as currently written. With the permit fees and fines proposed, I could not afford to continue mining. Small-scale mining is currently my main source of income to help provide for funds for future schooling. As I understand the changes, it will affect everything from suction dredging down to gold banning, and in reference to specific gravity. And this bill appears to have originally been written for large-scale mining, which we are not, in theory. As a small-scale operator, I would not be able to afford the fees. I respectfully ask you to consider the bill more carefully and or even throw it out. Thank you, Chair Representative Mr. Witt and committee, for this opportunity.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, can I add a little bit more to my
testimony?
Please do. Thank you.
Please do.
Appreciate the time to do it. I do own a small business that does consider mining. Currently, we hold 5 different mining claims. 2 are gold and 3 are Thunder Eggs. In fact, the 3 that hold Thunder Eggs is very close to the one that John mentioned about the operation over at Vail. We own the Skull Springs Thunder Egg claim. If you want to see a example of, there's one that is being displayed in the Capitol's display case downstairs or here on the same floor. I did want to add one other thing, and it actually was to add to maybe help out Mr. Chair, Representative Witsit. Hope I pronounced your name correctly. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Even though they had provided, these are some of the fees that could be imposed upon me as a small-scale miner. In fact, some of my mines are a little bit more than what you'd consider small scale. But anyway, to add to information for you, initial permit fee of up to $1,260, an annual fee of up to $2,500, possible inspection fees up to $1,200, and up to a fine of $50,000, this is interesting, $50,000 per day, that is per day, that I continue operations for any violation, and possibly receiving a Class A violation are too extensive. I cannot possibly afford to have these imposed upon me. And like I mentioned earlier, these type of things that more than likely will put me out of business. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. If we had questions on this bill and its impacts on you, would you be available for us to ask you those questions after this hearing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be make myself very available.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Tom Quintal and Robert Stumbo. Good morning, sir.
Waiting for him. My name is Tom Quintal, resident of Salem for 72 years, and over that time, I've seen a lot of changes in Oregon. Chair Witt, members of the committee, and a special thank you to Beth Petrino for helping so many times when I call her on the phone, and she gives me really good information. My concern, I think, while I realize this is a large-scale mining bill, the concern I have, I think, is that now we've got another agency to deal with. I mean, we deal with ODQ, ODF&W, DSL, and EPA. Yes, good old EPA. So now we have maybe Dogami to deal with. And the reason I say that is because they have changed this bill to say mining. They're encompassing mining. Mm-hmm. We can say, well, it's strictly for large operators, excluding placer miners. However, what I need is some clarification in this bill. If you look at the terminology used, they call it gravity separation by means of, for minerals and so forth by water and air. Well, these folks are in mining. Now, they obviously have to know that we use water when we're doing suction dredging, which is placer mining, and we also do off-stream mining. It's called power sluicing, high banking, whatever. So we withdraw water. Oh, that's another agency I forgot to mention, Oregon Department of Water Resources. They permit us also. We're permitted to death. And I guess my concern, again, is they say that placer mining is exempt. Now, what do they mean? I looked up their regulation, and, you know, while it covers large-scale mining through those RRS statutes, placer mining needs to be really clarified for the small-scale suction dredger, placer miner, if you will. I don't think they did that in this bill. I think they need to really get specific. If they're talking about gravity separation with the aid of water, that's exactly what we do. So now we've got Dogami on us. Now you say, oh, no, wait. This is only for large-scale operations. But where are we going to stop with this? How far down are we going to go? And I'm not sure, from what I've seen over 20 years dealing with state agencies, every year, because they use administrative rules, we get sandwiched deeper and deeper with restrictions. So I would just like to make sure that they do make this distinction when they say exempt from placer mining, and also the way they're describing in this section, I believe it's 6 on 7 here. Also, you guys remember when House Bill 2259 came up, and you saw the fee structure in that thing. It's crazy. I know they haven't raised their fees since 2002, I believe, and so now they're trying to make it up. And if you go on their website, it says we're closed on Friday due to budget constraints. Okay, but what I'm trying to tie 2248 with 2259, and I see this fee structure in here, and when you go from $456 to $2,500, that's crazy. I mean, how can we do that in this economy? I still think this would kind of, for an operator to come in and decide that he wants to maybe get into mining, yeah, they're probably going to be big operators, lots of money. Maybe those fees wouldn't scare them. I don't know. But I think it's a little excessive. I think there needs to be a little bit more restraint on the fee structures, not only in this bill and others. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's my feeling on this particular bill. So the way it's written, I oppose it. I really do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cantola, very much for your comments. Any questions of him before we let him go? Would you be available if we had questions?
Yes, I would. I'd be happy to answer
following this hearing.
Thank you, Chair Witt.
We appreciate your help very much.
All
thank
right.
you.
You bet. Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay, with that, I'm going to call up, please, Andy Benson, Rich Angstrom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, okay. We're not together, so we don't know what each other is going to talk about. Well, again, good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Andy Bentz from Malheur County, Ontario, Oregon, and I have a consulting firm, and I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2248. I represent a company that is going through the permitting process, or the pre-application process, actually. We're nowhere near permit request under Division 37 at this time for that particular mine that was mentioned 17 miles south of Vail, Oregon. Now, in regards to 2248, there's a couple things I can say on the behalf of Calico Resources, and that is that the way it appears, and we certainly already know about some of the amendments that will be proposed and added, in general, Calico supports this bill. And for a couple of reasons, and I'll move down through those. One, as I believe you know, Oregon suffers a horrible reputation throughout North America and actually the world financial investment environment for mining, mainly because we don't have any large-scale commercial mining. Calico believes that this bill will help level the playing field and bring more consistency to the process. A bit of a story here with this particular mine, Grassy Mountain claims, south of Vail. We really didn't have an option as a company to use Division 35 for the reasons that were stated by Mr. Lynch. They were antiquated, they were too weak, There was no regulatory structure that was going to assist. So there was really only one option, and that is to go the chemical mining laws under Division 37 and go through that process, of which we are doing. But anytime you can bring consistency and clarity to a process with the interaction and the interface between an industry and government and the regulatory agencies, it brings that dependability, and it calms the fears of the worldwide investment market, which we have to have. I heard it mentioned here. You know, rural Oregon, we're on life support and we're fading quickly beyond where life support's not going to help us. And those of you that know my background realize and know that I am not a miner. And I am interested in economic development and the survivability of our communities in rural Oregon. And we have to have this dependability and to bring these folks forward, to have them make the investment, so that we are able to bring those jobs and community wage jobs, not just family wage jobs, to our citizens that do not have employment opportunities or hope. Now, as I said, Calico supports the intent of this bill, which is a few little wonderments that we'd hope the committee, and we know DeGami is also paying very, very close attention, as well as the AG's office. But the public comment periods, we understand and we support the public's right to participate in these decisions and do not want to squash that. However, we do want some dependability again and some known factors, and that with our technology changes in our communications, we think that the length of time, possibly the amount of occurrences, but certainly the length of those occurrences and the placement of them are very, very important for that dependability again. But the technology changes, I believe, make it reasonable to shorten up those comment periods. Performance bond, I'm not going to get into because that's not something I know a great deal about long term. The penalty references in there, I think, would be important to make clear whether or not there is any opportunity for double exposure. For an example, if there is a violation found that falls within the jurisdiction of the DEQ, and there is a fine levied, is there also going to be one from EPA? And are companies responsible for both of those? And then we get to the technical review team side, which those of you that are familiar with 37 know what that is and how that works. We are 9 months into the process of working with the technical review team now for Calico on the Grassy Mountain project. And the size, we're not really sure right at the moment whether the size is almost to the point of being suffocating or out of control, for lack of a better term. The members certainly aren't out of control, but the size needs to have probably a pretty good look-see, and I would say that you can get pretty good direction from Director McConnell's office and Mr. Lynch's position. They certainly know the concerns and what's working, what's not working. But from Calico's view, first off, I want you to know, and something that you don't hear very often, I'm sure, in here, but the state agencies that are represented, at which there are a lot, but the members are good folks. There are some really, really good, talented folks in these state agencies that are working on this team, and we want to make sure people in your position know that. The company has made the commitment to work through this process as the guinea pig, if you will. It's costing us a great deal of money and a great deal of time, and time is money. However, the hope is here that on a policy position for the state of Oregon is that if we can be successful and if we can begin to bring this type of industry into Oregon, into rural Oregon, for the, almost the most part, that the flow of jobs and taxes coming to local and state government, that maybe we can begin to reduce the cost up front in the paybacks for the time, complete overhead of the participation of the state agencies and the TRTs. But that's something just to keep in mind. That does not mean to stop or hold up this process on this bill. And then also, again, with the size of that, we believe that there may be too many people, but we also think that nature will take its course as everybody learns this process, as they learn more and get more technical information and knowledge about the interface between the mining industry and their positions in their state agencies, that will address itself.
Mr. Benz, could you yes. Could you wrap it up, please?
Oh, yes. I'll quit right there.
All right.
Any questions?
That was a good timing. Rich, would you, before I hear from you, I just want to announce that we're obviously not going to have time to hear 2697 fish carcasses or 2032 fill and removal. I'm not sure those are connected, but I want to announce that officially for the public record, I am going to carry over House Bill 2697 to public hearing on Thursday, March 7th, and I'm going to carry House Bill 2032 over to a public work session on Tuesday, March 5th. Sorry for the interruption. Rich, please proceed.
Thank you. My name's Rich Angstrom. I represent the Construction Materials Association of Oregon. I have all the sand and gravel and asphalt folks. Our official acronym is OCAPA. And for those of you, I was invited to testify before you, and I know this is my first introduction with this committee. I was in D.C. working on highway funding and some EPA issues when you guys first met and couldn't attend the first hearing. So that's a little bit about the organization and what we represent. We're supportive of this bill. And for a couple of reasons. One is we're very supportive of any of the streamlining activity that the agencies are doing that combine and make it a little easier for the mining operations around the state. As has been discussed, it's amazing the amount of local, state, and federal permits that we have to get. And anything like this that maintains the rigorous environmental standards, but streamlines the process is good governance, and that's what this bill's about, is good governance. The other thing is because anytime anybody mentions mining in the Capitol, everybody goes to, oh no, it's another gravel bill, and you know, the sky's going to fall, and we're going to have huge fights. And this is not about Division 30 at all. It doesn't affect any of the sand and gravel folks. It also doesn't affect any of the industrial minerals like Oregon Resources. And so this is very important. I wanted to make sure I pointed that out for the coastal community, specifically Representative McEwen.
Thank you.
That they fall under Division 30. So that's important information. But the big reason is going to the fee question that Representative Whitsitt brought up, is the industry has taken a position in Dogami, and many of you that have been around a long time know this, that we pay for the full cost of the Dogami program through the fee. There used to be some general fund association with that. We got tired of coming over here and fighting the legislature about any general fund help for that particular MLR program. And we took a position that we want it fully funded through the fee program. Right now, most of the program is supported by the sand and gravel folks. And it's our opinion, and I don't know if it's Dogami's opinion, but we think so, given the numbers, that we support a lot of the other activity, whether it's geothermal and some of the research that goes on with
sighting of other minerals. And we don't want to have to carry the burden for all the interests that are out there. So the fee component of this is something that we're keeping a close eye on to make sure it's fair amongst the mining community and that those fees are distributed. I would echo, this is an amazing agency. They do a great job. They have really talented folks. It's good to hear that they've been assisting Calico and at that high level. They certainly assist us in information. The last thing, maybe help clarify some of the placer issues. You know, by definition, placer mining can be, it's just a removal of mining activity of an alluvial deposit. It could be upland or it can be in the rivers. And the way the state set up is DSL has anything below the ordinary high water line. So when they're in the rivers or above, you know, below that ordinary high water line, it falls under DSL's jurisdiction. If it's above that, the placer miners would have a point that it would fall under Dogami's jurisdiction, but there's a threshold, and it's 5,000 cubic yards of material before a permit's required. That comes up to, with a 30-yard dump truck, I believe about 180 dump trucks. That becomes pretty large scale. I can't imagine a placer miner, I've never heard of one that's moved that much material on an annual basis through their system. But if they're above that, they would have to get a Dogami permit. So I think that helps put in context some of that information and how I would look at that from at least the industry side. I thought that would help be helpful to the committee. With that, thank you for the time. I hope we do not add fish carcasses to the definition of material.
We have sex.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Committee members, we're just about out of time. Representative Krieger, did you have a comment. Quick question? Comment?
Comment.
Yeah. Please.
I want to make sure maybe we take a look at that we clarify some definitions.
Great.
Yes.
And make sure that the small operators are not going to be somehow drug great. Into this thing. Yes. And something in actual wording that says you are not going to be. Great. And I've always had a problem with civil penalties up to $50,000. Civil law judge, no jury, no court-appointed attorney, no representation. That isn't justice. We've already got one bill. You're reining DEQ in. Don't put yourself in the same bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Krieger. And I make the final comment that this bill is not quite ready for takeoff just yet. We've got significant opportunities here for economic development over in Vail, Malheur County. At the same time, I want to make absolutely certain that we're not putting some of our small miners out of business, and that we're not making it impossible for college students to pay for schooling. So we got a little balancing act left to do here. We're going to have our cake and eat it too. We're going to have big mining. We're going to have small mining, and we're going to do it the best that any state does it in the union. And Representative Whitsitt, would you be willing to help us make that happen?
Yes.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to adjourn our meeting.
Thank you.